Hi, I'm Cantor Harriet Dunkerley, and you're listening to Drinking and Droshing, Torah with a Twist. And I hope that you always remember to bring the very best you have to offer.
Hey, Gabe.
Hey, Amanda.
I think that we may have missed something.
What did we miss?
Well, so this week we're starting a new book, right?
Right.
But we didn't finish the last book.
Wait, what did we miss?
So, okay, we missed two portions, but they were really one portion because this year they were hyphenated.
Oh, yeah, that's difficult when that happens. Vayechel Pikudei, it's one thing, but it's two. It's very confusing.
But Gabe, how are people going to know that they need to be strengthened?
I mean, I guess we could tell them now?
Sure. So, okay. Or we could tell them, you know, at the rundown, maybe. But we'll see. We'll see how quickly you might be able to do the rundown of the end of Exodus and the beginning of Leviticus. But I have to tell you, it better be strong because our featured guest tonight is super strong.
I'm excited to see her.
Yeah. What a gift she has to offer.
Let's go.
Everybody, we really appreciate that you were willing to give our incredible podcasting team just a little bit of a break last week, and we hope that you enjoyed some of our classic Vayechel Pikudei or the solos Vayechel and Pikudei episodes that we posted for you on our social media. This week, we are so excited because we are starting a new book. Don't worry, Gabe, I'm sure, will say Hazak, Hazak, Vinid Hazak to end the last book, maybe before he starts the new book. But either way, we're really excited because we are starting a brand new book of Torah yet again, our third book of Torah, Vayikra or Leviticus, whichever way you like to say it, with a brand new first portion. And I'm so excited to bring in a somewhat unusual character to come in. We've had rabbis come in, we've had educators come in, but we haven't had a Cantor educator come in since about a year ago around this time, when we had an incredible Cantor educator come on, Josh Rosenberg from Temple Beth Elohim in Wellesley, Massachusetts. Today, we have another incredible, I would say, Cantor educator, solo pro, and also like just angel of her Connecticut congregation. And of course, somebody who helped me really embrace high holidays in a special, unusual way for the first time in my fifth year of rabbinical school. And so it is such a pleasure to be able to have Cantor Harriet Dunkerley joining us today. Cantor Dunkerley joined Temple B'nai Chaim in July 2020 as its spiritual leader, cantor, and director of education. Don't worry, we're sure she sleeps, we're just not sure when. She holds a master's degree in sacred music from Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religions, New York campus, where she was ordained as a cantor in May 2019. In addition to this work, her cantor has been deeply impacted by the unit of clinical pastoral education she completed at St. Luke's, Mount Sinai West in Manhattan, her learning as an Artsa Fellow at HUCJR, her participation in Hazon's Jewish Food Conference, her explorations into Jewish mystical traditions, you know, she just had a few things, and her educational travel to underserved communities in Lithuania, the Republic of Georgia, Azerbaijan, which interestingly enough, Gabe has a relationship to, and the West Bank with Encounter and JDC Entwined through their partnerships with HECJR. Among the recognitions for her work as a student at HECJR, of which she was most proud, wait for it, because this is impressive, are the Manuel and Ida Hoffman Memorial Prize in Liturgy, the Riverside Memorial Chapel Prize in Human Relations, the Ruben Peretz Abelson Prize for Dedication to Yiddish Song, and the Gavi Klonsky Award for Amitz Lev, Spirit, Character, and Strength of Heart. Since ordination, Cantor Dunkerley has served as cantor for Greenwich Reformed Synagogue and as chaplain for Greenwich Chaplaincy Services, where she provided spiritual care and Jewish cultural enrichment programming for two different facilities in Connecticut. So just so you know, no wonder she's just, you know, crushing it at Temple B'nai Chaim. That's pretty impressive. But wait a minute, hold on. I bet you're like, that's who she is, but what does she believe in and what kind of inspires her? Well, before we could ask her that question, she gave it to us in her bio. So Cantor Dunkerley is passionate about the power of music to teach, lift prayer up to God, create spiritual connection, transform worship and bring community together. Her own poll quote says, as an educator, my focus lies in supporting our community of learners, regardless of age, to discover the many joys and treasures of our Torah and our tradition so that each of us has the knowledge and skills we need to live thoughtful, engaged, Jewishly grounded lives. Cantor Dunkerley, we are so thrilled to welcome you to the show. Welcome to Drinking and Joshing, Torah with a Twist.
Thank you so much, Amanda and Gabe. I'm really excited to be here. I am looking forward to a great conversation. I'm so excited to talk about Parashat Vayikra with both of you and learn with and from both of you as well. Thank you for having me.
We are thrilled to have you, and we are so excited to get to learn with and from you as well. And Gabe Real Steiner, how are you doing? I love the syncopation I just had on your name when I went Gabe Real. But Gabe, how's it going? And do you want to discuss the relationship that you two have to Azerbaijan?
So I don't actually have a relationship with Azerbaijan other than when I was in high school, I represented Azerbaijan at Model UN. That is the extent of my relationship with Azerbaijan. I know a few too many like weird facts from the CIA World Factbook about Azerbaijan, but about beyond that, I got nothing.
Name one.
Among its chief exports are coal, natural gas, wine, and rugs.
Excellent job. I mean, it's like you were there.
Seriously. Yeah.
Definitely rugs. Seriously beautiful rugs in Azerbaijan.
Incredible. I really appreciate you giving us that offering, Gabe. And I think that we are really excited to see what might be offered for the rest of this episode. So let's get started.
And that's Parashat Pikudei, Chazak Chazak V'nit Chazek. All right, welcome to Leviticus. It's a bloody one. God likes the smell of burning animals, so we're gonna do that. Say Ola to the Ola. That's the burnt offering. The whole unblemished male animal gets put on the altar. Bull, sheep, goat, or bird. There are some specifics on how to cut it up, but basically chop it up, put some blood on the altar, and turn the whole thing into smoke. For a mincha, the meal offering, we go vegan with choice flour and oil and frankincense. You can make it into a cake, but it can't be leavened. You can also bring an offering of the first fruits of the season. I feel like I would like the smell of this one better than the Ola. Also, Aaron and sons get to eat some, which is nice. Next up, Zevach Shelamim, the sacrifice of well-being. This one can be a male or female animal, also without blemish. It is slaughtered at the entrance of the tent, and its blood is dashed on the sides of the altar, and the flesh is burned along with some specific organs, also all of the fat. Fourth up, Chatat, the sin offering. This one is given to annul unintentional sins. There is a special ritual with blood where the priest brings the blood into the tent and dips his finger in the blood seven times and puts it on the altar of incense, and then the rest of the blood goes on the altar of the burnt offerings. Much like the two meaty sacrifices, there are specific guidelines for the flesh and the organs and the fat. Interestingly, the ritual varies slightly depending on who committed the sin, a priest, a leader, a chieftain, or a regular Israelite. Lastly, Asham, the guilt offering, given when a person knowingly does a bad thing. Once they realize the error of their ways, they are to confess and offer a female sheep or goat in the same manner as the sin offering. But if the person is too poor to afford a sheep, they can bring two turtle doves or two pigeons, which I'm pretty sure are the same thing, one for the sin offering and one as a burnt offering. If they can't afford two pigeon or turtle doves, they can give 1/10 of an ephah of choice flour. How much is an ephah? The volume of 432 eggs. So, you bring 43.2 eggs worth of flour to the priest, and they perform a ritual. This one is not like the mincha offering in that it doesn't get any oil or frankincense. It just gets split between the altar and the priests. Did you mess up on any of the offerings? There's an offering for that too. No matter the situation, there's an offering that goes along with it, each with very specific instructions. And that's Parashat Vayikra.
Wow, that's a lot. That's a lot of blood and a lot of dashing and splashing and very specific instructions. And one thing that strikes me when I read this parasha is we don't offer that kind of sacrifice anymore. So, no.
Yeah, that's a weird thing. So we come back to this every year at this end. Don't worry, if you miss this one, there's a lot of other sacrifices in the Torah. There will be more blood and guts and gore and animal sacrifice. So, like, why do we still, you know, revere this? Why do we still keep reading this year after year? What's up with that?
So one of the things that strikes me is the parsha is called Vayikra, the name of the book, Vayikra as well. Vayikra, and God called. It's an action. This parasha is all about action, right? And so Vayikra has a little aleph at the end of it. If you look at the Torah, all Torah scrolls have that final aleph written much, much smaller than the rest of the word. So there's a midrash that talks about that aleph, saying that there was a disagreement about whether it was Vayikra and God called or Vayikar and God happened upon. God doesn't usually just happen upon, but they made a compromise. And so the aleph remains, but it remains small. So to me, it's a call to action. And in reference to this guilt in the parasha, all the descriptions that you were offering talks about how if one incurs guilt, what does that mean to incur guilt? So incurring guilt, you know, you do something wrong, you feel badly, but guilt is like you wallow in guilt. It's kind of like an excuse to continue feeling bad about yourself, to allow yourself to feel unworthy. But if we're all created in the image of God, if we're all created B'Tselem Elohim, we are not less than, we are not unworthy. We are in fact very worthy. And so it's a call to action to take responsibility for times when we have done wrong, either purposefully or out of ignorance or just by accident, a method, a call for us to own up, to take responsibility and to be in action in the world to make amends, to do teshuvah, so that we can move forward.
Well, I'm really excited to talk with you more about this Torah portion, about you, about your work, and about how it all goes together. That's coming up right now.
Harriet, I know that I was really lucky enough to get to learn personally from and with you, especially around the High Holidays time. And I got to see your energy and your leadership just bouncing off the walls on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. I mean, there was even a moment where you got so excited that you had to lay down on the floor, and it wasn't even for, like, you know, the great Amidah. It was about a shofar blast. You were so ready. And so I have to ask, there's so much joy in the job that you do. What inspires you? What beliefs kind of accompany you on your way? What calls you to do this work?
Ma Vayikra Ani. That's really poor Hebrew, but what calls me, framing it from the Torah portion. So I do feel called to this work. I do feel like there is a divine voice. And so I'm a cantor because music has always been an inspiration for me. Music to me is the vehicle that lifts prayer up to God. I think you said that at the beginning when you were reading from my bio. And that remains true. And what is important is to communicate the possibility of drawing people into a closer relationship to the divine. I mean, I know you, when you introduced me, you read what, as an educator, I feel my responsibility is. Ultimately, though, as a cantor and as the spiritual leader of my community, my job is to make the space into which people can have a closer experience of the divine through music. That's inspiring. And Torah inspires me I love everything about it. I love chanting it, especially because I think that that helps to tell the story. And I get very inspired working with young people to reveal ways or to guide them in such a way that they can discover ways that Torah remains relevant in their lives today. So it's great. Like, we received Torah at Mount Sinai thousands of years ago. And Gabe and I just had a little conversation about, yeah, this Parsha has like sacrifices and blood and everything. And as we get more into the book of Leviticus, there's a lot more of that. And then we get to talk about skin diseases and, you know, diseases in the home and all of that stuff. How is it relevant today if students who are preparing for B'nai Mitzvah cannot see a relevance to their lives today? It becomes pointless. So I'm inspired by conversations that I have with our young people about how the Torah and its lessons can be a refuge, a structure, a guide, a place to come, to turn to for guidance in living their lives today, for inspiration when they are facing a challenge, perhaps. It's inspiring to me to coach somebody writing, a young person writing a Devar Torah, and get their view on whatever it is that they're studying, how it impacts or can impact their life in this moment today.
You know, when I was first applying to cantorial school, I was coming out of my undergraduate degree in religious studies, and I did some music there. I did, you know, some of the opera stuff and the choral stuff, and I took voice lessons, but I wasn't a music major. I wasn't a music minor. I really should have taken a lot more music classes before coming to cantorial school. If I could do one thing differently, it would be that. But people would ask me, you know, why would you go the, you know, cantor route rather than, you know, why not just be like a musical rabbi? Like, there are rabbis who sing. There are rabbis. My rabbi plays guitar. Why can't you be a singing rabbi? So I just want to like pose that to you. What's the difference for you between being a cantor, being a chazan, and being a rabbi who might also sing? Rabbis can like music. Amanda loves music. She's going to be a rabbi very soon who loves music. What's the distinction there for you?
That's such a great question. And I must say that I was a performing arts major in school, and I focused on voice and acting. And I also wish that I had taken more specific music classes. And I also wish that my mother had not let me quit guitar lessons when I was 12. She says that she could only force me to practice so much, and then she just gave up. That's a great question. So I think for me, I guess that the connection to spirit for me has always been music, not just Jewish liturgical music or Israeli music, which I do find very, touches me in a very deep place spiritually. All music, live music, is an entryway for me to a spiritual experience, to a closer proximity to the divine. Chazanut, the art of chant. There's something about music that is able to convey a deeper meaning in some cases, in many cases, I think, than what the spoken word alone is able to do. So for me, that connection is stronger and doesn't even have to be music with lyrics. The power of that mode, that modality, the emotion in music doesn't exist in the same way for me as it is found in words, if that makes sense. You know, even working with, you know, patients who have lost the ability to speak, whether it be through a traumatic brain injury or a stroke, perhaps, in my chaplaincy work, Sometimes the only way that I could reach someone was through a song, just sitting and singing with them. I would sit and read Psalms, didn't have the same effect, but just a simple song or a melody. So I think that's really why, for me, the path to which I was called was the cantorate rather than the rabbinate. Not to say that I won't get to the rabbinate eventually.
So I have to say, I'm really glad that you were excited to take on this portion, which is a tricky portion, but it wouldn't be me if I didn't see something that like sparked an interest in me right away. And I hope it will make you excited too. And what I wanted to say was in this portion, in Leviticus 1:7, for people who are listening at home, we have a line where it says, "The sons of Aaron the priest shall put fire on the altar and lay out wood upon the fire." It's really interesting because when we think about like creating fires, right, we think about wood first, then the fire comes from the wood. But here in this portion, right, it really just says, "V'natnu b'nei Aharon ha-Kohen eish al ha-mizbeach," that the sons of Aaron are going to put the fire, right, onto the altar, "V'arhu etzim al ha-eish," and then they'll put wood on the fire. Now, Gabe is smiling, but I'm not sure he knows where I'm going with this yet, but he should, because it's one of his favorite portions in the world to sing out loud, and I'm bringing it up because we actually went over this portion when I was with you at the High Holidays, that here, this actually connects, believe it or not, to one of the first like real sacrifices that we hear about, we know about. I know Noah also gives a sacrifice, but actually here, Abraham and the Akedah, what's really interesting is Isaac says to his father in Genesis 22:7, weird, 1:7, 22:7, weird, right? Gabe says it doesn't make a difference, but I think it's an interesting connection. But he says, right, "Hine ha'esh v'ha'etzim," right? Here's the fire and here's the wood. "V'ayeh ha'seh le'olah," like, where's this offering? And Abraham says, well, God's going to see to the offering. And so I really have to say, I think that there is something really beautiful about being called or coming across a sacrifice that has been generations, that there's fire first and wood to kind of create a spark of beautiful connection and lehakriv to, you know, draw us near. And so I'm curious for you, what sparks of creativity and connection are you able to find in the work that you do to a portion like this, which might seem like really cut and dry and not connected to like a fun story, but might actually surprise you?
Great question. I mean, I don't know, for me, like there's sparks of connection and creativity like almost every day. Every day is a different day in my work. And love what you said. I mean, I picture the priests, when it says like the priest will lay fire onto the ark, I picture that fire is like, I can almost smell it, like it's incense. It's not like, so it is, it's a, maybe it's embers, maybe it's burning incense onto which the wood is laid, and then we wait for the sacrifice. I mean, I guess for me, the spark of creativity is just calling out like how, or maybe not calling out, but delving more deeply into, well, if we're not doing sacrifices today, then what do we do, right? And so today what we do is we have a service in the synagogue where we have that same structure. We don't lay fire on the bima. We don't put wood on, but we do light candles and we do sing prayers and we do have sort of a similar structure where we're not bringing a turtle dove / pigeon, equally the same thing. I agree with you, Gabe. We're not, you know, pinching off its head, but we are offering a barchu and we are offering a shema. So we do have that mabea. It's just not a physical mabea, but we pray with our bodies. Things like introducing forms of embodied prayer to my community where there is a physical connection. Vayikra, the parsha, it's a very physical parasha all of that splattering and so forth. So maybe introducing to my community or asking my students, well, what would it be like to embody this somehow, to offer some kind of an embodied practice of prayer, to introduce a connection that way, maybe internally instead of so externally, by exploring a mindfulness practice with the community, those kinds of things. Those are the sparks that I see.
I am curious about, you know, going back to the conversation we were having just a few moments ago about, you know, the difference between a rabbi and a cantor and what a cantor does and how this portion is really about, you know, not a liturgical practice, but certainly a worship practice. This was the practice of how the Israelites related to God. And sure, we don't have priests and altars anymore, but we still have God and we still have ways in which we relate to God, not through sacrifices, but through liturgy, through prayer, through music. And so I'm curious how we map our contemporary world onto those practices. Do you see yourself as following in the line of Aaron and sons? Do you see yourself as a priest, or do you see yourself going in a different direction? I ask this because when I think about what a cantor is, I think about the Hebrew word for cantor, which is chazan. And I think about how chazan in the biblical Hebrew comes from a word that means not to be a priest, but to be a prophet, to prophecy, to prophesy, chazah. And so I'm curious about how we see ourselves following in the line of the priests, of the prophets, you know, how our contemporary liturgical practice maps onto this ancient, may I say, kind of gross practice that we read about today.
You know, I think about the priest, Aaron, as a conduit, right? Aaron was a conduit, and Aaron's sons were conduits, and the high priests that followed them were conduits between the community and God. And the vehicle for their connection was, yes, all, as you said, kind of gross, but that was the practice of the day. And, you know, perhaps it was the practice of the early Israelites because that was the practice of the communities around them. The communities that from whence they came, you know, let's go back before the covenant, the ancient peoples that worshiped idols, they worshiped idols through sacrifice. And so, you know, a transition perhaps was for the Israelites to engage in sacrificial worship because that's what they were used to. And so perhaps that was less of a leap for them then to accept the idea of one God was to, instead of sacrificing to idols, to sacrifice to one God instead. But that I digress from your question. So if Aaron and the priests are conduits and really the prophets, so conduits from congregation to God, Moshe Rabbeinu, conduit from God to community, just like the prophets, conduits from God to the people. I also see the role of the chazan in a similar way. We are conduits through our music. The prayer of the congregation, if you will, can be lifted up to God. That's not to say that I see myself as a priest or priestess. I haven't had training, so I can't really embrace the title of Kohenet, and I respect that title, and I wouldn't consider myself a prophet. That said, I do see the mapping of our role as conduit from people, from community to God through the lifting up of music. And, you know, the role of the cantor is so versatile and different depending on the community in which we are serving. And so in my particular community, I do not have a rabbinic partner, and I I do my best to take lessons of Torah, which, whether we believe it's the direct word of God or the word of God as filtered through humanity, to transmit, to translate, to engage my community in words of Torah in such a way that lessons and teachings are made relevant to them. And that's another form of being a conduit.
So I love the idea of being a conduit or being right, even a vessel, like a clay kodesh, right? Like a holy vessel that helps people pray or play or prep for, you know, the things that they're willing to give and receive within a space. And I love what you've said because it makes me think not only of congregational spaces, but also of conversational spaces. And so this is a question we always love to ask every guest that we have. But as a conduit, maybe not even from the prophet or priestess stage, but as somebody who really tries to accompany people on their Jewish journeys and you know, their life cycle moments, if you had one message that you could give or one, you know, special, I want to say like map, right? Almost like a trail guide message that you could give to people who are on this journey with you and want to lift up spiritually. What message might you have for people who are listening to not only the music, but the music beneath the music?
I would turn back to sort of what we were talking about at the beginning of our conversation, this difference between Vayikra and Vayikar, that little aleph, right? So to say, to pray, you know, that works for me, doesn't work for everybody, but Vayikra is an active calling. It's an action. It's a taking of responsibility. And I would couple that with, you know, maybe one of the many lessons that perhaps we can take away, or maybe we took away a number of weeks ago when we were celebrating Purim and we read from Megillat Esther, to always look for, and in the case of Vayikra, listen for the hand or the voice of God. Even though it may not seem like God is present, you know, in Leviticus, when Vayikra begins, we are at the tent of meeting. There is a cloud, the cloud has descended, and the presence of God is there. We don't have the tent of meeting anymore. The temple is destroyed. And so God now dwells among us. V'asuli migdash v'shochanti b'tocham, so that I may dwell among them and within and around them. So if we are always looking for that hand of God, listening for the voice of God, it's present in the smallest of miracles, the smallest of exchanges. So that would be my message. If we are created B'Tselem Elohim, and we each carry within us a spark of the divine, then conversations between us carry that same energy. So I would encourage people to continue to look for and listen for the hand and the voice of God in their day-to-day interactions. Yeah, we might not be crossing a parted sea. We might not have that kind of huge miracle, but the small miracles, God is there in every child's cry, in the blooming of a flower, in the snow that's falling outside my window right now. And we are often so focused on just the demands of everyday life that it's a challenge to stop, to even remember, to look for those small miracles.
Yeah. Hey, Gabe.
Hey, Amanda.
You know, I've been thinking a lot about these sacrifices.
Yeah, what about them?
Okay, so I find it really fascinating because I think it would actually be really hard to give a sacrifice.
It's pretty bloody and, you know, animals are heavy.
Even before that, buddy. So would you agree with me that humans are not perfect?
Yes, humans are not perfect. Very much agree with that.
Okay, so you would say that, like, for instance, like, we have some imperfections on us.
Yeah, we're all flawed.
Okay, and would you say the same for animals, that most animals probably are imperfect?
Yeah, no. I think I see where you're going with this. Yeah, no, they're not perfect.
Okay, so, I mean, I'm saying that in order to give a real sacrifice, it would need to be something so special, right? And kind of really hard to find, that there would be no blemishes whatsoever. I mean, like, what kind of person could create that sort of perfect, clear offering?
Well, I'm glad you asked, Amanda, because this week for Midrashic Mixology, we have the unblemished offering. To give us that feeling of cleanliness, we're starting off with 6 mint leaves, one for each of the offerings found in Parashat Vayikra. Those go into a highball glass with a lime slaughtered and butchered into quarters, and 2/3 of an ounce of simple syrup. Make it like a meal offering and muddle all of that together to get the lime juice and mint and sugar all combined. Add in 1.5 ounces of vodka and ice for simple purity. Top it off with seltzer to taste and stir it all up. The seltzer is all effervescent, with the bubbles floating up like the smoke to God's nose. For a non-alcoholic offering, experiment with different flavors of seltzer. Lime is an obvious choice, but there are many other fun options. Raspberry for blood, pomegranate for blood, or also mitzvot. The possibilities are really endless. Regardless, finish the cocktail with a mint leaf and enjoy. Here's to a new book, L'chaim.
Amazing! I can't wait to taste that.
I'm excited to try it with you. Next time you're in Brooklyn.
L'chaim.
L'chaim.
Well, I certainly can't say that I'm unblemished, but I'm really grateful for what I've been able to offer and also the offerings that have been given here today. I am sad to say that, like, we're pretty much at our penultimate offering, right? We're at our thank yous and closing cues section already, which is really strange. But who knows? Hopefully we'll get, like, a meal offering or a peace offering as we're moving our way forward. And so, Harriet, Gabe, Vayikra starts off by discussing the idea that we need to make sacrifices, korbanot, in order to create closer relationships, in order to draw people near, lehakriv, right? The same root. What are some sacrifices that might be healthy for us to make in order to draw closer with others or to help strengthen a relationship? Harriet, we'll start with you.
So I think we have to sometimes sacrifice our own agendas, right? Like, we may go into a conversation with an idea of how that's going to look and what I'm going to say and what they're going to say. And to really be present fully with someone requires a sacrifice, perhaps, of just like letting go of that, letting go of what you want your outcome to be, letting go of what you think the other person's going to say, and just to be there, present for them, and allow them to speak into an open and supportive space. I think that's an important thing to remember.
I agree. I love it because I left. I was like, oh, I wonder if she's talking about this episode. But hopefully we ran according to your agenda. And if not, hopefully it was a delightful pivot.
Completely.
Gabe, what sacrifices do you feel like might be necessary to make in order to create a stronger relationship?
I think, A, that Harriet had a great answer. I think that was A+ answer. And I think for me, the word sacrifice in English is very limiting. It puts us in a weird place because in English, we think about sacrifice as giving something up, right? We think about it as putting something to the side or away or not having access to it anymore. When in reality, that's not what sacrifice means. That's not what it means in Torah, in Hebrew. And it's frankly not what it meant in Latin, from which we get the word sacrifice. Sacrifice comes from the word sacred, like set apart or distinct or holy, and, you know, the word to make. And so really, all sacrificing something means is to make it holy, to make it different, to set it apart. So my argument would be that if you want to have a closer relationship with somebody, then you need to see them as sacred. You need to see them as holy. You need to see the sacred in them, allow the sacred in you to be one with the sacred in them. It's very Buberian. You'll have fun with that, Amanda. But yeah, I think that instead of talking about giving things up, think about the holiness of it. Think about the holiness that exists in connections between people.
I feel very well taught of my own thesis topic, so I really appreciate that. In terms of when talking about Buber and relationships and connections, but I would also say, like, I think that they're not so different, this idea of sacrificing, making holy, or offering something up. It's a giving of yourself, right? And so I want to say, like, we have a godly example of that. You know, if we think about the world being created and God doing simsum, like, right, God contracting in order to make space for creation, then I think there is something to be said about the fact that if we're willing to give of ourselves, even if that's a positive, even if we don't necessarily, like, you know, have like a huge net loss, like, giving of ourselves requires some sort of loss, right? Some sort of actual gifts that we've given something of ourselves to create this relationship. And I think for me, I'll be honest, and maybe you'll laugh, I'm pretty okay with, like, giving up anxiety or self-doubt or self-criticism when entering into a situation. You know, I know Harriet, you talked about giving up your agenda, but I would also say maybe giving up some of those pre-assumptions, right? Of what am I going to sound like, or what are they going to think of me, can be really, really powerful. And here's the deal. It's really funny. Gibbs, like, you know, look, this makes holy, but guess what? If you make a mistake or you make an error or you, like, are blemished in some way, congratulations, listeners, you're not going to get sacrificed. Like, that's exciting. Like, you know, that's a good thing. And so I would say, you know, being able to maybe get rid of those really, like, self-doubts or self-criticisms of what makes us imperfect is something that could really draw us nearer to someone else and you know, Gabe, maybe set us apart also and let ourselves embrace each other and our imperfections, all of which comes to light, of course, in conversations like this. And so, Kandor Dunkerley, if people want to continue the conversation with you, how can they best find or follow you?
Okay, I will answer that question. I just love what you said. And I think it's essential. Like, not only would that, you know, letting go of agenda, sacrificing your self-doubts and that kind of thing, it also not only opens up the opportunity for, you know, you to draw closer to another, it also offers up the opportunity for you to draw closer to your true, you know, higher divine self. I mean, honestly, it allows you to drop those filters and, you know, see the beauty of who you are inside and then draw closer to the divine. So I just had to say that. Anyway, how can people best find or follow me? They can email me at cantorharriet, 2 R's 1 T, at templebeneichaim.org. They can click on our website, which is the same, templebeneichaim.org. They can message me on, you know, old school Facebook Messenger at Cantor Harriet. Yeah, that's the best way.
I love it. I am really excited for people to be able to really hopefully continue the conversation. Or, you know, if you're in Connecticut, go by, visit. They're such a nice community. I loved working there. And so I hope that you get to enjoy some of the kindness and just community feel that I got at Temple B'nai Chaim.
Yes, come visit. Come visit. We're right in Wilton. Come visit us.
I was going to say, any last words, thoughts, concerns, or jokes, but I think you said it, right? Come visit.
Come and visit. Yeah. And you're welcome anytime.
I love that you're welcome, because it sets me up to say thank you so much for being here and for sharing your wisdom and your wit with us. We are so grateful to have had you on. And it's just been such a pleasure to get to learn with and from you today. Thank you so much, Gabe, for an incredible rundown and an awesome, almost imperfectly perfect. Wait, what was the Mary Poppins? The practically perfect, right? The practically perfect unblemished offering drink this week. Great. We're doing awesome. Thank you, of course, to our listeners for listening in as always. Thank you to our editors for making us sound brilliant, even when we make silly mistakes like I do on the regular. And thanks to you, Dawn, for actually continuing to take some time off. We hope that you enjoyed your vacation away, and we can't wait to have you back with us soon. Stay tuned. Our conclusion's coming next.
Hey, Amanda.
Yes, Gabe?
So I know we've talked a few times about one of my favorite musicians of all time.
Katy Perry?
Okay, no.
Taylor Swift?
Okay, you are getting colder. I was going for Leonard Cohen.
Oh, Leonard Cohen. I get it. Okay, go on.
Okay, so in one of Leonard Cohen's most famous songs, Anthem, which was released in 1992, he writes, "Ring the bells that still can ring. Forget your perfect offering. There is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in." And I've been thinking about that line, particularly the forget your perfect offering, because, you know, this Torah portion is all about offerings, and it's all about finding that perfect, unblemished offering, and, you know, the methods by which we are to sacrifice it to God.
Yeah, I mean, like, in a little bit of the off time that we had when we were speaking with Kendra Dunkerley, she actually said a beautiful thing that talks about our Torah setting us up for people who may not have the means to bring the perfect offering, that they have the ability to bring the best that they have to offer, which is a really beautiful sentiment, right? That, like, our best for us, our 100%, can look different every day, even if we're not talking about physical sacrifices, but we are talking about just being present or showing up, that our 100% is going to look different every single day. And I think that, you know, Vayikra talks to that, right? This idea of, are we called to do something? And if so, what does that mean? Or if we just happen upon it, you know, what can we bring to that situation that is really our true 100% for that moment?
As Cohen would say, ring the bells that still can ring. You still do the thing. That wasn't intentional as a rhyme. It just kind of happened. But you still do something, because even though there's a crack in everything, that's how the light gets in. That's what makes us individuals. That's what makes us unique. And that's what brings us the beauty of the Jewish tradition, is how things change and evolve over time. And so it's really amazing to have a discussion about this Torah portion that, you know, was written thousands of years ago, about a practice that hasn't actually been practiced in thousands of years, in a place where none of us live. And yet we all still talk about it, and we talk about it as our heritage. We talk about it as something that, you know, this is a part of who we are.
I think that that's really important to remember, that it is in some ways a part of who we are. Our friend Gabby, shout out to Gabby Hohn, who is an avid supporter of ours, both, you know, I would say on the podcast and off the podcast, is actually giving her senior sermon on this portion, and is talking about how it connects to Shalom Bayit, right? Like, how it connects to really creating a beautiful home. And one of the things she said to me recently that struck her was the Shleimim offering, the peace offering, was the only one that you took and then you brought it back home to eat, so that you were literally bringing shalom into the home. And I have to tell you, like, I think that that is in some ways also really relevant to this conversation of what we're able to bring out into the world with us and what we're able to take home with us and how to experience our past in the present. And I think that was something also that Kendra Dunkerley was talking about really powerfully, this idea of maybe we don't take the fire and the wood anymore, but we do light candles every single Friday night as a way to, I guess, in a different way, let the light come in.
You know, we carry this forward. We carry forward our traditions. They might not look the same as they did a couple thousand years ago. Probably don't look the same as they did 10 years ago, because we're constantly changing. We're constantly learning. We're constantly evolving. But we have this ever-present thread, this light that we carry forward from generation to generation. It's been such a pleasure discussing this portion for now, what, the third time on this podcast with you. This has been a really, you know, wonderful experience. So thank you for joining us this week on Drinking and Droshing Torah with a Twist. We hope to see you next time. Until then, check us out at drinkinganddroshing.com. Get in touch, buy some merch. We'll see you soon. And as always, L'chaim.
L'chaim.
Hi, I'm Kendra Harriet, and you're listening to Drinking and Droshing Torah with a Twist. And right now, it looks like there's manna falling from heaven. But actually, I think it's just snow. And maybe it's time to make dinner. I'm hungry.